Hello, my name is Dave Emery, and in this next half-hour segment, we're going to continue with our discussion about the development of circular flying machines in the Earth's atmosphere. This discussion is accessed from the book Intercept But Don't Shoot by Renato Vesco, published by the Grove Press in 1971. And in turn, the reading of the information about the development of the Kugelblitz and the Feuerball, two German anti-aircraft devices that were fielded during the closing months of World War II, and which appear to be the prototypes for real UFOs. Again, not produced by space aliens from hell, but rather real circular flying machines that were developed in the Earth's atmosphere and have been flying for a good half century or so. This information is excerpted from the lecture, The Political Implications of the UFO Phenomenon and the ET Myth. This was given in October of 1992. So in thinking of what in all probability was the immediate post-World War II development of, quote, flying saucers, imagine a Frisbee, okay, obviously with a solid bottom. The top half, the curved portion, is made out of sintered metal. That is the air intake for this form of jet engine. A turbine or turbines are moving around inside, sucking in the boundary layer of the atmosphere as fast as it is developed. And instead of expelling it out the back, one exhaust, there are a series of nozzles around the periphery of the aircraft, which can be rotated at 360 degrees around their axis and fired in any degree of arc around the circumference of the aircraft. The aircraft, in order to get it to fly straight, would be spinning, and you'd have a gyroscopically stabilized cabin. Obviously, if the thing's going to spin, you can't have the pilot going around like this. It's not going to work too good. But just imagine this. You know, take a look at a jet engine at an airport, on a commercial airliner. Take a look at that multi-bladed propeller, that turbine in the front of it. Imagine that sitting inside of a Frisbee. Obviously, the bottom of the Frisbee would be closed. The Frisbee is made out of sintered metal, and there are a series of nozzles around the periphery of the aircraft. These would be the exhaust, and those nozzles can be rotated at around 360 degrees around their axis, and they can be fired at any sequence of arc, any degree of arc around the periphery of the aircraft. And you have a gyroscopically stabilized cabin. You would have an aircraft that could fly much, much faster than anything that we had ever conceived of, because there would be no wind resistance. The boundary layer of the atmosphere would be sucked into it as fast as it could form. And in turn, the exhaust would be expended around the periphery of the aircraft, and you could turn the nozzles at a 360 degrees around their axis. You could have them fired off on one side or behind it or in front of it or off to this side. And so the aircraft could perform like this. It could move like this. It could go up. It could go down. You can basically think of it as a cross between a jet engine, a Frisbee, and a helicopter. One dandy piece of aeronautical engineering and applied physics, but not something which needs to have been developed by, quote, ETs, unquote, or our brothers from space, quote, unquote. One of the things Vesco points out is that a number of eyewitness accounts of aircraft that UFOs that had crossed contrails made by aircraft, as the UFO crossed the contrail, and this is, again, in the immediate post-World War II period, the contrail was observed to have been cut through by the aircraft. This would have been as the suction wing aircraft moved through it. It actually bit a piece. It cleaved a section right out of the contrail, that visible part that you see, visible trail that you see behind an aircraft flying in the upper atmosphere. That, in all probability, was what the very first UFOs were. Again, a dandy piece of technology, hell of a piece of aeronautical engineering and applied physics, but nothing that cannot be conceived of by human beings. And after having read Vesco's account, it really sort of blew the entire notion of ETs or anything from outer space. This is something that, if I can understand it, and I'm not a physicist and I'm not technologically well-versed, it's something that I think we can assume was developed on a fairly wide scale. Now, Vesco believes that these things were developed by the British, in all probability developed by the Avro Company, the Avro Company, a Canadian subsidiary of Hawker Siddeley, a British aircraft manufacturer. Many people might be familiar with the Hawker Hurricane. That was actually the mainstay of the British Air Force during the Battle of Britain. The Spitfire was the better-known aircraft, but during the earlier stages of the Battle of Britain, it was actually the Hawker Hurricane, which carried most of the burden of combat against the Luftwaffe. One of the things Vesco points out, and he maintains that, actually doesn't maintain, he documents that the United States Air Force and the Canadian Air Force were working on developing a circular flying machine, basically a, quote, flying saucer, unquote, that was going to be deployed in the middle or late 1950s. And, in fact, the so-called Avro car, again to be developed by the A.V. Roe Corporation, the so-called Avro car was actually test-flown, and although it supposedly was never deployed in long-term or long-distance upper atmospheric flights, in fact, a great many commercial and military pilots saw so-called flying saucers, which very closely resembled the so-called Avro car. What I'm going to read next, and I've read this before on the program, is a statement made on October 25th, 1955, almost 37 years ago to the day. And this statement comes from the U.S. Secretary of the Air Force at the time, a guy named Donald Quarles, Q-U-A-R-L-E-S. And he's in here, we're going to hear a press statement released by Donald Quarles to the general public about the development of the Avro car. And in a section that Vesco calls the Quarles Statement, on October 29th, 1955, Air Force Secretary Donald Quarles released a statement through the press office of the Department of Defense permitting the ATIC to divulge some of the conclusions it had reached after its investigation of the UFOs. Among other things, Quarles declared, quote, We are now entering a period of aviation technology. Now, this is 1955. Okay, that's almost 40 years ago. Quote, we are now entering a period of aviation technology in which aircraft of unusual configuration and flight characteristics will begin to appear. The Air Force will fly the first jet-powered vertical rising airplane in a matter of days. We have another project under contact with Avro Limited of Canada, which could result in disc-shaped aircraft, somewhat similar to the popular concept of a flying saucer. While some of these may take novel forms, such as the Avro project, they are direct-line descendants of conventional aircraft and should not be regarded as supernatural or mysterious. Vertical-rising aircraft capable of transition to supersonic horizontal flight will be a new phenomenon in our skies, and under certain conditions could give the illusion of the so-called flying saucer. The Department of Defense will make every effort within the bounds of security to keep the public informed of these developments so they can be recognized for what they are. Quote, and then now next, Vesco puts Quarles' statement in italics. I think we must recognize that other countries also have the capability of developing vertical rising aircraft, perhaps of unconventional shapes. However, we are satisfied at this time that none of the sightings of so-called flying saucers reported in this country were, in fact, aircraft of foreign origin. Unquote. Whether it was deliberate or merely a slip, even the newspapers failed to catch it, Quarles got his tenses all wrong. He was talking about aircraft of the near future, while the flying discs belonged to the past and not a very recent past at that. According to news stories in the American papers, the new Avro project was the latest Frost project and was described as an aircraft resembling a plate turned upside down. Finally, with 180 adjustable nozzles distributed around its perimeter that would make vertical takeoff possible, and then by changing the angles of the nozzles enable the craft to move forward, sideways, or backwards, skipping down. Talking about an alleged demonstration of the Avro car for Field Marshal Montgomery of El Alamein fame, the Battle of El Alamein, for openers, Field Marshal Montgomery was involved again. It was said that he had been given a model of the new machine. A few weeks later, another, quote, well-informed, unquote, but anonymous source boldly declared that England had a considerable fleet of flying saucers at the ready in Canada and that Field Marshal Montgomery had been present at recent highly secret maneuvers of these craft. Quote, these machines, unquote, the cautious reporter wrote, quote, were built by A.V. Roe and then shipped to a special secret airfield in the center of the country, unquote. Now, again, supposedly the Avro car was never deployed, that it just was an experimental aircraft, never really used in any serious fashion. But what we've just heard is a press statement, a press release by the U.S. Secretary of the Air Force almost 40 years ago. Now, one of the things that we have to think about is what we have seen in the Cold War period. The Cold War really began immediately after World War II, and it has entailed the better part of a half century of intensified technological research, much of it secret. If we think about the advances in aviation that were made between the flight of the Wright brothers in 1903 and 1943, when the first V-1 rocket bombs were falling on London, we've seen an enormous acceleration in the development of aviation in 40 years. Well, it's been more than almost 40 years since, actually almost 50 years since the end of World War II. It has been almost 40 years since Donald Quarles made that statement. In other words, it is a period of time almost equal to the period of time elapsed between the flight of the Kitty Hawk in 1903 and the first large-scale use of the V-1 flying bomb during World War II. In 1943, the Germans first successfully flew the Heinkel 163, the very first jet-powered plane, soon followed by the Messerschmitt 262. If we think about the acceleration in the development of tactical combat aircraft in the World War II period, at the beginning of World War II in 1939, the state-of-the-art interceptor aircraft was the Messerschmitt 109, which was under research and development in the early 1930s. By the end of World War II, the state-of-the-art experimental technology concerned the Feuerball and the Kugelblitz. In the Cold War period, we have seen almost 50 years of accelerated and largely secret technological development. And yet we have been told that there have been no significant advances in aviation made. We still have rockets and jet planes, albeit much more sophisticated, much more powerful rockets and jet planes. Yet, with the exception of the application of computer technology to rockets and jet aircraft, we are told that there have been no major advances in almost a half century of accelerated technological research. Well, personally, I wouldn't bet on that. I think that having seen Quarles' statement almost 40 years ago, again, an historical period almost equal to the historical period, or almost the equivalent of the historical period that elapsed between the flight of the Kitty Hawk and the first use of the V-1s, I think we have to be on the alert for the very distinct possibility that there have been major breakthroughs in aviation technology, which would appear to us, the unknowing, as obviously being the product of a, quote, superior, unquote, race, obviously coming from, quote, another planet, unquote. And I'm afraid that what we can assume has probably happened in almost a half century of intensified secret research, namely the development of something entirely different, as Monty Python put it. I think we have to be ready to confront something like that in the future, perhaps in combination with other technologies such as, again, perhaps the use of genetic engineering, holographic projection. Something Harry Martin of the Napa Sentinel has been doing some work. His series was concluded a couple of months ago. He was doing some research on a top-secret military base in Napa underneath not a mountain range, but in a hilly area and deep underground. This supposedly was a contingency base for having VIPs go underground in the event of a nuclear attack. But eyewitness accounts of people living near it this has been corroborated by a number of the eyewitnesses, have reported something strange. Now, I'm not going to discuss this on the air because this isn't something Harry necessarily wants talked about, but a number of the eyewitnesses, because we really can't achieve objective verification. This is anecdotal evidence, and I don't place that much credibility in that. But the people around this military installation have described seeing a beam of light shot up into the sky from the vicinity of this base, four clouds then appearing at the various compass points in the air and then drawing together. Now, I don't know what in the world, if in fact those eyewitness accounts are accurate, I don't know what in the world could produce something like that, but it sounds to me like some sort of experiment or some sort of breakthrough in applied physics beyond what the layman or laywoman could possibly conceive of. And I think we're going to have to be on the alert for the possible application of technologies far in advance of anything we have contemplated. Something else that's interesting, I recall seeing a series of articles in the New York Herald Tribune in 1955, again the same year that Donald Quarles released that press statement, referring to experimental breakthroughs in, quote, anti-gravity, unquote, technology. Now, again, I'm not a physicist, and it would be the height of pretense for me to attempt to evaluate those critically. I noticed that the articles were run for several days, and many prestigious scientists endorsed the concept that these experiments would soon result in a complete breakthrough in aviation technology. Whether that breakthrough was achieved, whether this was some sort of deception to fool the Russians, I can't say. But in almost a half century of secret military development, I think we're going to have to be on the alert for the distinct possibility that there have been machines developed way beyond our understanding or beyond what we have been led to believe exist, and that at some point we could see something which, in the event, again, suppose the ozone layer disintegrates well past the point it is now, and that's a possibility. Suppose the banks collapse. Suppose that the number of people believing in fundamentalist religions of all kinds increases. I think we may very well have a population that would be only too ready to receive, quote, our brothers from space, unquote. And at this point, you know, think about Orson Welles' War of the Worlds broadcast. No men from Mars, no heat rays. They were broadcasting at periodic intervals that this was nothing but a radio play, and people flipped. They went off the deep end. Just imagine how people would react if we had a real visitation by real UFOs. We were told that these are creatures from outer space, a superior civilization, and that we shouldn't panic. People will believe it if the government says that. I think at some point we're going to have to be ready for something. It may not happen at once, and I can't say when it's going to happen. I may be talking about something that could happen in 2 years or something that might happen in 100 years, but I think we have to be prepared for an event unparalleled in human history that would be something like a cross between Orson Welles' War of the World broadcast, The Miracle of Fatima, and Pearl Harbor, with effects just as profound from a religious, political, and sociological standpoint as an infusion of those events would have. I'm going to conclude the formal part of the lecture this evening by just reading a few newspaper clippings of some of the things that have been appearing in the news over the last couple of years. Article from the San Francisco Chronicle of June 6, 1990, more than 2 years ago. UPI story, Dateline Stratford, Connecticut, headlined, quote, flying saucer, unquote, vehicle unveiled. Sikorsky Aircraft unveiled yesterday an unmanned air vehicle that resembles a miniature flying saucer, which could someday be used in the war on crime. Sikorsky executives said the Cypher vehicle is being submitted for competition in the Defense Department's unmanned air vehicle program to meet U.S. military needs. Although designed for specific military surveillance, communications, and similar missions, the vehicle has great non-defense potential, said James Sikon, chief engineer and program manager for the project at Sikorsky, a major helicopter manufacturer. Civilian uses could include the forestry and utility industries, as well as law enforcement work, including efforts to counter illegal drugs and assisting in search and rescue missions. The vehicle could be a boon to law enforcement agencies as a safe and simple way to crack down on border drug smuggling, as well as aiding police surveillance in high crime areas, said Sikon. Now, if that's not a great name for an aeronautical engineer, Sikon, that's terrific. C-Y-C-O-N, sounds like a name of a company here in Silicon Valley. Just 6 feet in diameter, the Cypher is a rotary wing system with a circular shroud that gives it the appearance of a flying saucer. The Cypher will carry a payload of 130 pounds, have a 65-horsepower engine, and be able to cruise at 80 knots with an endurance of 4 hours and a ceiling of 8,000 feet. And that's just basically a helicopter with a sheath over it. Now, reading from the San Francisco Examiner of Friday, June 5th of 1992. Again, that very same column, Down to a Science, by Kay Davidson. This particular section of the column, this UFO is leaving traces. It's a bird. It's a plane. It's classified. Something weird is flying over the southwestern United States. Witnesses have observed and photographed jet contrails shaped like beaded strings. The contrails are repeatedly interrupted by oblong, quote, puffs, unquote, perpendicular to the main trail. Naturally, Pentagon officials deny they're testing any secret aircraft, but, quote, the contrails are consistent with exhaust characteristics of several advanced propulsion concepts, such as a pulse detonation wave engine, unquote, says Aviation Week in Space Technology. An Amarillo, Texas man photographed a beaded or, quote, sausage link, unquote, contrail accompanied by a, quote, strange, loud, pulsating roar, unquote. The Cold War is over, but old soldiers never die. They just develop new weapons. Just listen. And from the Wall Street Journal of October 10th, 1990, Belgian scientists seriously pursue a triangular UFO. This is by Tom Walker, special of the Wall Street Journal, Dateline Brussels, skipping down. Eminently sober-sided burghers saw the thing. It appeared on radar screens, and Belgium's armed forces as well as UFO specialists have taken the sightings rather more seriously than Flanders headline writers. Over the summer, the Belgian Air Force and Army even organized a weekend of UFO hunting, putting two planes at the disposal of the Belgian Society for the Study of Space Phenomena, SOBEPS, and civilian scientists who were studying the phenomena. The airborne flock of intellectuals zigzagged back and forth across Wallonia chasing UFO reports. Last week, the École Royale Militaire, the Air Force training school, began computer-aided analysis of UFO photographs. Preliminary studies of these and of radar echo studies by the Free University of Brussels are expected to be disclosed this week. At the end of the month, scientists from all of Belgium's main universities are due to meet to discuss the matter. Quote, there's at least one photograph that is well worth investigating, unquote, says Leon Brennig, B-R-E-N-I-G, a nonlinear dynamics theorist at the Free University, adding that the Air Force has, quote, much better facilities than we have for this sort of thing, unquote. Professor Brennig, whose department is studying radar echoes, is a former skeptic who claims to have seen a UFO himself in the spring. And again, I want to emphasize, as I conclude the main body of the lecture, that I am not an aeronautical engineer, I am not a physicist. However, I can smell an okey-doke when I am brought next to one, and the whole question of UFOs as originating from outer space or else being nothing but the planet Venus on an unusually bright night, that smells to me, and again, it exudes that old familiar odor.
Again, that information was from a lecture entitled The Political Implications of the UFO Phenomenon and the ET Myth. That material in turn read from Intercept But Don't Shoot by Renato Vesco, put out by the Grove Press, copyright 1971. And another key excerpt from Intercept But Don't Shoot concerns the Mantell case, and I'm going to present that information also once again from that very same lecture.
Virtually every UFO book and all of the UFO books that I have read deal with one of the best-known contacts with UFOs, namely the Mantell case. Now, Captain Mantell was an experienced combat pilot who was was on an air patrol near Fort Knox, Kentucky in 1947. Actually, maybe it was 48. I believe it was 47 because I'm operating from memory here. Mantell was flying a P-51 Mustang, an aircraft with which he had a great deal of combat experience. That was the best tactical combat aircraft produced by the United States during World War II. It saw combat service well into the Korean War. And Mantell was on a patrol with two other pilots also flying Mustangs. A huge UFO was sighted over Fort Knox, Kentucky, also a very strategic area like Washington, D.C. Of course, Fort Knox is where the U.S. gold reserves are held, at Fort Knox. And the three pilots gave chase. This enormous UFO was able to elude them. Two of the pilots began to run out of fuel. Captain Mantell still had enough fuel, so he continued the pursuit. And the UFO was seen by ground operators as well. At one point, the UFO remained stationary in the air. Mantell began to close with it. And again, he was an experienced combat pilot with over 3,000 hours of flying time, much of that in aerial combat during World War II. This is not a guy who's going to mistake the planet Mars or the Venus or a weather balloon or a thermal mirage for a huge flying machine. This is a guy who was trained to recognize enemy aircraft from friendly aircraft in an instant, an experienced pilot who also knew how to deal with trouble with his aircraft. As Captain Mantell closed with this huge UFO, he began to approach it, and then there was a huge roar, and his plane exploded. The wreckage was scattered over thousands of square feet, and it was noted that the pieces of wreckage had odd perforations in them, as though they had been hit by a very powerful blast of something. Virtually all of the UFO books go into this, and all of them interpret the phenomenon in the same way, namely that Captain Mantell had alarmed our brothers from space and that some sort of very mysterious weapon was used to destroy him. This indicating, A, that our brothers from space are far more powerful than we are, and that we shouldn't do anything to alarm them because their technology is such that they can trash us in a minute. All of the UFO books, virtually all of them, all the ones I have read, go into the Mantell case, but none of them, except for Renato Vesco, report Mantell's last transmission to his ground control. Renato Vesco goes into that, and he points out, and reading again from Intercept But Don't Shoot by Renato Vesco, however, one of the personnel at the Godman Control Tower later revealed to a member of the British Flying Saucers Bureau, a private association dedicated to the investigation of UFOs, that there was a sequel to the story. Shortly afterward, that is, after closing with the UFO, by the way, most end with his last transmission, quote, it's still above me, making my speed or better. I'm going up to 20,000 feet, and if I'm no closer, I'll abandon chase. Again, continuing, however, one of the personnel at the Godman Control Tower later revealed to a member of the British Flying Saucers Bureau, a private association dedicated to the investigation of UFOs, that there was a sequel to the story. Shortly afterward, Captain Mantell did manage to get within closer distance of the UFO when it made a brief stop in the air. Quote, my God, he then exclaimed on the radio, again quoting, there are men in it, unquote. The rest of his words, if there were any, were drowned out by an indescribable crescendo of noise. Then came a terrible crash, and radio contact was broken. There were other UFOs as well. I found it very significant that that last transmission is not generally reported in the accounts of the Mantell case because it is terribly significant.
That again from the lecture, The Political Implications of the UFO Phenomenon and the ET Myth, given in October of 1992. And again, that information excerpted from Intercept But Don't Shoot by Renato Vesco, Grove Press, copyright 1971. And I mention that because of the New York Times article from yesterday, June 14th, with which I began this two-half-hour segment series. And it discusses that article, by the way, by Amy Herman. Again, New York Times, 6/14/97, front page. And it describes a recent Gallup poll which says that 42% of college graduates believe that the U.S. has been visited or that the Earth has been visited by UFOs from outer space. And the indications are that the UFOs are real, but they don't come from outer space. They come from right here on Terra Firma. And again, all of these half-hour segments and the various interviews I've done, the weekly One Step Beyond shows, the archive shows, and the lecture tapes distributed by Spitfire, that's one word, S-P-I-T-F-I-R-E. They can be contacted at P.O. Box 1179, Post Office Box 1179. That's in Ben Lomond, California, capital B-E-N, capital L-O-M-O-N-D, zip code 95005. The email address is A-L-C-A-L-A-M-E, that's A-L-C-A-L-A-M-E, at ix.netcom.com. Once again, the email address, A-L-C-A-L-A-M-E, at ix.netcom.com. You can obtain a list of all of the various shows available from Spitfire, as well as a description of those programs. You can dial up the KFJC webpage at www.kfjc.org. Again, www.kfjc.org, and look in the Public Affairs section. That concludes this half-hour segment. My name's Dave Emery. Thanks for listening.